The following Dharma talk was recorded in February 2014 in Kansas City, Kansas. It is one of eight recordings from the retreat called Awakening with Insight, Cultivating Concentration and Mindfulness, taught by Shyla Catherine and Phil Jones. The retreat was sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. If you like this recording, you can find more talks at www.midamericadharma.org. For questions, we welcome your emails sent to info@midamericadharma.org. Shyla Catherine is the founder of Insight Meditation South Bay in Mountain View, California. She has practiced meditation since 1980 with more than 8 years of accumulated silent retreat experience. Shyla has authored two books, Focused and Fearless, A Meditator's Guide to States of Deep Joy, Calm, and Clarity, and Wisdom Wide and Deep, A Practical Handbook for Mastering Jhana and Vipassana. Find out more about Shyla at www.imsb.org. Phil Jones has been teaching insight meditation since 1996. He has studied with teachers from Spirit Rock and the Insight Meditation Society, and graduated from the first Community Dharma Leader Program in 2000. Phil has served on Mid-America Dharma's Board of Directors since the mid-1990s. Find out more about Phil at www.silentmindopenheart.org.
So I've titled this talk, Relax, Let Go, Keep Trying. And I want to begin with a quote from Bhikkhu Bodhi that I find quite telling. This was from The Inquiring Mind a few years back. He wrote, "The unenlightened mind for the Buddha is a whirlpool of deluded emotions, kept spinning by three toxic streams and four deadly floods. It is blocked by five hindrances, harbors seven latent tendencies, and congeals into four bonds, four knots, and 10 fetters. Soiled by 16 mental corruptions and prone to 44 types of misconduct, we recklessly meander along the 10 courses of unwholesome action, reaping their bitter fruits." Now, with a worldview like this, you might wonder how anybody could dare relax. But many of us come to meditation actually with the explicit intention of learning relaxation skills. We may intentionally use meditation to decompress from the strain of our lives, the pressures from work and family, economic pressures, and interpersonal responsibilities. In the West, very often, there's a merging of the interest in relaxation and meditation, so much so that it might surprise you to learn that the Buddha did not teach relaxation, acceptance, or letting go. Certainly not as we understand these terms. And yet, time and again, you will hear contemporary Buddhist teachers, I admit it, myself included, encouraging you to relax, to accept things as they are, to let go. Why is that? I've seen in my own practice and also with working with many students that relaxation is actually an extremely important component for personal transformation and for profound insight. And it is absolutely essential for the deepening of concentration and the experiences of samadhi and jhana. Jogi Nima Rinpoche wrote, "We may need permission from time to time to allow ourselves to relax, to not be so hard on ourselves, to simply be at ease and happy. We need to learn to be kind to ourselves." And so teachers very often encourage this and encourage you to give yourself permission to relax. But what does it actually mean to relax? What is genuinely relaxing, restful to the mind? From the perspective of Buddhist psychology, states of desire, the adrenaline rushes of thrills, of lust, of pride, often the things that accompany a lot of what people reach for entertainment, actually doesn't produce the effect of relaxation. It produces agitation, craving, fear, conceit, rather than ease. Unwholesome states that are rooted in dosa, ill will and fear, or lobha, greed and lust, do not have the mental factors that produce genuine ease and trust in the mind. Whereas wholesome states of calmness, of insight, of concentration, of mindfulness, of wisdom, of tranquility, even if they're not very exciting, will be infused with the wholesome states that in Pali are called lahuta, mudita, and kamanata, translated as lightness, malleability, and workability. Relaxation could be considered to be a mental state that is at ease in the present moment, light, buoyant in the face of things, malleable, workable, responsive. It's a state that is upright, responsive in the situation at hand. There are many practices that emphasize relaxation or produce joyful, wholesome, restful states of mind. But more important than the specific practice that you might choose to do is the attitude that you bring to it. Because we can approach almost any task or practice with tension or ease. It depends a lot upon our attitudes. So I want to mention a few practices that I found to be very conducive to cultivating deep relaxation. The first is to consider the body. What is a relaxed posture? Now, the average person probably thinks that a slumping posture is relaxed. You know, if you ask somebody on a bus to relax, they might just sort of slump down. But slumping actually creates tremendous strain on the spine and on the muscular system. A lot of tension enters into the body when we slump. A genuinely relaxed posture instead will skillfully use the support of the skeleton. And so it's worth giving some time to learning to sit with ease, to align ourselves with gravity, so that this perpetual force that is exerted on our body all the time, just gravity, becomes a support for relaxation rather than a strain. We can also consider the breath as a practice and support for ease, release, and relaxation. And there are many practices that use the breath to consciously relax the body and the mind. And Phil introduced a few of those practices this morning. There are a whole range of them. Some where we even the breaths, some where we lengthen the breaths, some where we slightly hold the in-breath or slightly hold the out-breath. In many ways, they bring sensitivity and an alertness to the system, to the body, to the mind. And in this practice, we generally use them in great moderation, like two or three breaths, or just a few moments here and there. Because basically we are not controlling the breath. We're just skillfully using the breath to calm the mind or to balance the energy of the mind, to awaken a dull mind. It's important to find some comfort with your own breath. And if your breath isn't obviously comfortable, to bring an attention to it and a sensitivity to explore the breath in a way that you can find a comfortable breath, an ease-filled way of breathing, so that the breath is not at all forced. We're not trying to contrive a particularly spiritual breath, certainly not a perfect breath. And it doesn't need to be long. It doesn't need to be deep. It doesn't need to be short. It doesn't need to be subtle. Just observe your own breath in a way that finds ease within it, comfort within it. Now, although we have not taught the body scan on this retreat, many people find it very comforting to move the attention from the top of the head through the whole body, discerning various sensations throughout the body. And it can be a lovely way of beginning a meditation session to ground the attention in the materiality of the body. By performing the body scan, we move our attention systematically, part by part, without preferring one sensation over another, without judging one experience or another, so that we develop an even and unbiased pace of observation as we observe the various elements and material qualities of the body. As we do the body scan, if we take it as a primary practice, relatively quickly, the perception of the solidity of the body might break down. And then the body is not experienced as anatomical parts, but as ephemeral sensations, changing vibrations, the momentary appearance and disappearance of material elements, of the characteristics of matter that arise and pass away. Another approach to relaxation is to just make a commitment to relax with whatever is present, to have that as the intention, to open the senses to seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, to whatever is happening, and to let go of any struggle with it, to receive it as it is in full awareness, with a mind that is at peace with it, at ease with it, relaxed with it, able to be present with it. Trust that you can be with this, even if it's boring, even if it's painful, even if it's not what you planned on, and even if it's not what you wanted. Perhaps, though, the ultimate relaxation meditation instruction that I've been given was from my Tibetan teacher, who gave me primarily two words of teaching in the years I spent with him. He said, "Just relax." Again and again, he would tell me, "Just relax." But when he said it, he would throw his arms back, lean back, open his mouth, and kind of rest like that. And he would say, "Just relax, What a meditation instruction. Can we let go of all preoccupations, all interpretations, all doings, conceivings, strivings, and thoroughly relax? Whatever our approach to meditation, it can help to find calmness, ease, and contentment in simplicity and simplicity in our lives simply by inclining the mind towards relaxation, towards ease. This ease implies a state that is not struggling with experience, not conflicted, not agitated, not contentious, and not partial. It lets experience be what it is. And it develops a peaceful relationship with it. A relaxed state is a state of profound equanimity, where the mind is not pulled into the extremes of desire and aversion. Equanimity describes a willingness to be equally attentive to all things, just because they are. And so with equanimity, we connect with mindfulness and with wisdom. Upeka might be translated literally as to see from above. And so the essence of equanimity describes a state of balanced observation that just sees things happening. Often, though, we don't just see things as they are. Often we expect certain things and go poking around looking for them. Expectation is an enormous obstacle to equanimity, because when we're expecting something, we are not observing what is actually occurring. Plans, hopes, fears, goals, comparisons, assessments, anticipations all take our attention away from what is presently occurring. But in this wholesome state of equanimity and relaxed observation, the mind is just not worked up over things. It's not upset and agitated. It's not working ourselves into a tizzy of reactivity. Relaxation lets us open up to and trust our experience. Relaxation brings attention into the here and now, and it's only in the here and now that we will ever actually know peace. Let yourself rest in the here and now to find ease right now with current conditions. Not compulsively moving to gain something, to describe what is happening, to turn it into a narrative or a story, to try to keep it or repeat it. Craving can too easily cause us to neglect where we are now for the promise of something better later. But don't believe those seductive stories of craving. Really, what is better than now? You don't need to construct a fantasy of a future when you will be successful. What is now is most important. To allow the mind to be calm and still and quiet. And from this space of stillness, see what is real, what is really happening. When your mind is still and at ease, deeply relaxed, you're not going to be pulled outward with craving, and the attention will easily settle into a deep experience of what's happening right now, what is real right now. The suggestion that you relax your mind is an encouragement to settle deeper into your present experience, whatever that experience might be of. Perhaps it's as simple as sitting and breathing. Perhaps it's as focused as the experience of the meditation object. The instructions for developing jhana absorption specifically invite deep relaxation. As I said the other day, that there are three qualities of mind that are very supportive of absorption. To have a mind that is relaxed, spacious, and alert or bright. But don't try too hard to create these states. Don't try to do too much. Let the expectation and the forced striving come to an end, and just look at the mind and relax. In this moment is what is most important. This is where we can relax. Trust the unfolding of the Dhamma path. Observe this moment without craving for anything else. I was reading a book by John Muir and picked up several wonderful quotes. Do you all know who John Muir is? I don't know if he's as famous in this part of the country as he is in California, but he was an amazing naturalist way, way back when, and is probably one of the people most responsible for having the national parks and the preservation of land in deep, deep forests like Yosemite and some of these real wonders that unfortunately might well have been destroyed by growth were it not for John Muir and people like him who dedicated themselves to loving and preserving these lands. He wrote, "Wherever you chance to be, always seems at the moment of all places the best. And you feel that there can be no happiness in this world nor in any other for those who may not be happy here." Now, the second part of this talk is about letting go. What do we need to let go of? What is letting go about? Given how frequently we hear meditation teachers say, "Let go," I know I've said it a lot. It's interesting that there are virtually no references to letting go in the discourses of the Buddha. Okay, it comes up a little bit, and I'll tell you those contexts. In the middling discourses, the term letting go appears three times. And they're nearly identical stock quotes, where it says, "And what is the cessation of suffering? It is the remainderless fading away and ceasing, the giving up, relinquishing, letting go, and rejecting of that same craving. This is called the cessation of suffering." And the other quote is virtually the same. "What is called the cessation of identity by the Blessed One? It is the remainderless fading away and ceasing, the giving up, relinquishing, letting go, and rejecting of that same craving. This is called the cessation of identity by the Blessed One." So what do we let go of? Clearly, what we're letting go of is this same craving, is craving itself. And there are three kinds of craving that are identified in the Buddhist teachings that Phil spoke of the other night when he spoke of craving for sensual pleasures, craving for becoming, being, or identity, and the craving for non-becoming or non-existence. When we crave for something or some experience, when we crave to become something or avoid something else, or assert the self into experience through demand and desire, reaching out to seek satisfaction. When we crave, we are discontent with the present moment, disconnected with what is real right now. In that moment of reaching for something else, the present experience is unsatisfactory. There is dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, or we might say suffering. What does your mind reach out for? What did it reach out for today? Did you notice what lured your attention away from your meditation object? Did you notice what hooked to the mind? We can catch ourselves being hooked being enchanted by something, and then turn the attention to reflect on what's going on there, right there. Not in the future through a fantasy of when we're free, but right now, turn our attention to what's happening. Oh, craving, grasping. When we turn our attention to see that grasping, seeing it with wisdom is the letting go. Because when we are now mindful, we are not craving. And it could be said that we have let go of that same craving. That's the moment to relax. And it could be said when we return to the breath that we are then letting go into the breath, letting go into our meditation object. The Buddha taught the way to end suffering, to end the suffering that is caused by craving. And this is encapsulated in the third noble truth, to abandon the cause of suffering, which is craving. This is not an abstract and impossible teaching. We can all let go of our preoccupations with personal patterns. We can relax the construction, the busyness around I formations. We can let go of desire and lust, wanting, clinging, craving, attachment. We do not need to avoid our perceptions. We do not need to stop experience from arising. We don't need to go home and throw away all our possessions in order to let go. The practice of letting go focuses on our relationship to our perceptions. We're investigating our response to things to see how we relate to life and to the patterns that condition our perception. If we find that in that relationship we are craving, that craving has arisen in the mind, then we do something skillful about it. But usually right in that moment of seeing it, we have abandoned it. We have let it go through the power of clear seeing. When we see craving, it's pretty hard to choose to indulge in it, isn't it? Oh, yes, I see myself suffering. Let's do more of that now. Oh, I see how ignorant I am. I think I'm going to do more ignorant things right now. No, we do all this because we don't see it. In a moment, we are blinded, and we don't see the craving and the ignorance that is at the root of our unskillful experiences and actions. We are not seeing how we feed it. But the moment we see how we feed unwholesome states, we stop feeding them. It would be crazy. It is some sense of self-preservation, right? Oh, let's just suffer more. Let me increase this unwholesome, unpleasant, unsatisfactory state. We just don't do it. We only do it because we are not mindful, because we are not seeing clearly. Practices of mindfulness and investigation and renunciation all support each other to weaken craving, to weaken that pattern that keeps stimulating more craving. When craving is weak, meditation becomes remarkably easy, pleasant, peaceful. The mind is calm and clear. But if we think that we need to do a lot, to struggle to let go, to create a lot in our meditation practice, to produce and perform in our spiritual lives, then I think we're manipulating our experience a bit too much. If we're trying really hard to gain spiritual experiences, or to develop a spiritual lifestyle, a very spiritual personality, talk the talk, figure out what the spiritual walk is, figure out what the spiritual dress is, what the best color shawl is. Kind of developing that spiritual Buddhist personality. Then we're doing way, way too much to construct the self, because it's doing that constructs self it's doing that creates that, that it, doing itself is a subtle form of craving. Yet if we do nothing, what will happen? For the most part, we'll be pulled along by habitual tendencies, just like any ordinary person who has never meditated a day in their life. So the suttas speak of giving up, relinquishing, letting go, and rejecting of that same craving. This is an encouragement to stop fueling the wanting. We must stop reacting in habitual ways. We must refuse to feed our fetters. We don't need to create more spiritual experiences. We don't need to be a different person, have better sensations. And we don't need to be reborn again and again to keep going around this craving existence. We just need to see how craving operates. And when we see how craving operates, we will stop fueling it. We will discover that in the absence of craving, we are right here with what is real, where we are, present in the here and now, and the mind settles deeply in concentration and sees clearly the nature of things. Having relinquished craving, we discover that we are intimately present with what is. Again, from John Muir. Here it is 6,000 or 7,000 feet above the sea, yet in all that tranquil scene, we feel no remoteness. For us, there is no past, no future. We live in the present and are full. No room for hungry hopes, none for regrets, none for exultation, none for fear. But you might ask, how can we know that peace when we're below 7,000 feet? How do we learn to let go? I had a student that came up to me and complained. And he said, you say let go, but this really doesn't help. Because obviously, if I knew how to let go, I wouldn't be suffering. How do I let go? But letting go is not really a technique. It's not something that we learn how to do. It is instead an undoing, a cessation of a habitual pattern, a cessation, an ending of clinging, of craving. It happens without altering our experiences of what we see, hear, smell, taste, or touch, or what we know in the mind. It's a manifestation of wisdom and clear seeing that occurs through the development of our mind, mindfulness. When we see how our habits feed unwholesome states, we stop feeding them. We just stop doing it. That's the letting go. Starved of energy, craving ceases. It's not really that we let something go. We certainly don't push something away. Things come and go naturally. But when we see clearly how we cling, that's what we stop, is we stop the clinging. We stop fueling the attachment. Because it's only the desire, the lust, the craving, the clinging that we must abandon. Not the experience of the senses, not the experience of feelings. This is the practice of letting go. In the Sutta Nipata, it says, as a drop of water does not stick to a lotus leaf, or as a lotus flower is untainted by the water, so the sage does not cling to anything seen, heard, or thought. Now, the last third of this talk is on keep trying. I want to encourage you to keep trying. Meditation does not always bring instant results. We have to be willing to persevere on this path. The Buddha is famous for one of his deathbed teachings. That was one of the final teachings he gave in his life. In Pali it says, Appamadena Sampadetta, strive on with diligence. Strive on with diligence. We must be willing to look at our experience diligently and then respond appropriately. In the Middle-length Discourses, there's a very simple teaching that says, friend, a bhikkhu reviews himself thus. If he sees that these evil, unwholesome states are not all abandoned in himself, then he should make an effort to abandon them. But if, when he reviews himself thus, he sees that they are all abandoned in himself, then he can abide happy and glad, training day and night in wholesome states. So basically, one looks at the mind. You've been doing that for days. What do you find? Those moments when you find that there are unwholesome states? Then you make an effort to abandon them. You work skillfully with them. And when you find in the mind that there are wholesome states, then you're happy, you're glad, right? And you have the conditions to continue to train, to balance the energy, to take advantage of that condition, that wholesome condition, to further your concentration, to deepen your mindfulness. And the simile that's given is of a man or a woman, young, fond of ornaments, might look into a mirror or into the reflection of the face on a surface of water, and look to see how she or he looks, and is there any blemish on the skin? And if one finds some blemish, you know, some dirt or some mark or something, then they take some water and make an effort to rub it away, make an effort to clean it, make an effort to remove it. But if she or he sees no blemish, then happy and glad, they continue on their way. And similarly, a practitioner looks at the mind. Because unwholesome states are likened to blemishes. And they're blemishes that we look at, we see, and then we remove, we wipe away. It's as simple as that. But we do indeed diligently work with these unwholesome states. We don't just let the dirt and the filth accumulate on our face. Right? We wash it off. And we don't let the dirt and the filth accumulate in our minds. We clean it up. And then when it's clean, we train day and night in wholesome states. The emphasis here is clearly on doing something. It's not a passive acceptance. It's not a personal or selfish relaxation. And it's not an indiscriminate tolerance of whatever happens to be arising. We apply ourselves to the meditative development of the mind. We bring wisdom to our experience to determine what needs to be done. Wishing for awakening is not enough. Wishing for peace, wishing for wisdom does not make it happen. There are three similes that I'm very fond of from the Anguttara Nikaya, and the first I'm sure you're familiar with, but I love it so much I'm going to tell you again. And it's of the hen who sits on the eggs. You know that one, don't you? Yeah. So the hen has to sit on her eggs, right? And for quite a long time, because she's nurturing the conditions that will allow the chicks to break out from their shells. The hen has to put in the time. The hen has to make the effort. Or the conditions won't come together and the chicks won't be able to break out from the shells. The effort is necessary. The diligence is necessary. The sustained attention, the sustained effort. But there's another image that's given in the same discourse, and this is of of a woodcutter who is chopping wood, and somebody who chops wood their whole life has a favorite axe. And as they are chopping wood day after day after day after day, they realize that the imprint of their hand has actually formed in the handle. Their hand has worn away the wood of the handle because of the effort of striking again and again and again and again after years and years of work. Now, the woodcutter will not be able to say which day wore away which part of the wood, but there's no doubt that that consistent effort indeed did wear away that wood. And in a similar way, a meditator may not be able to say which sitting or which insight wore away the fetters, but indeed, this practice does wear away the fetters. And then a simile with fetters is of a boat whose ropes are rotted by the sun and the salt and the seawater and the wind. And because they're exposed constantly to the elements, they get worn away and weakened. And similarly, when the fetters and the root, the unwholesome tendencies of mind are exposed again and again to our diligent practice, to our meditative efforts, they wear away, they get weak and brittle, and will no longer tether us, will no longer be a strong binding force. And so with these images, we can be encouraged to just plod along consistently, to do the work over a period of time. And we might at some point look back and realize, oh, maybe I did accomplish something. We might not know it in short periods of time. It might be only after years that we realize there has been a change. In the Anguttara Nikaya, the Buddha says, whatever wholesome states there are, they are all rooted in diligence. Converge upon diligence, and diligence is reckoned the best of them all. Authentic transformation requires diligence. In the Middle Link Discourses, it says, for a faithful disciple who is intent on fathoming the teacher's dispensation, it is proper that he conduct himself thus. Willingly, let only my skin, sinews, and bones remain. Let the flesh and blood in my body dry up. But my energy shall not be relaxed so long as I have not attained what can be attained by strength, by energy, and by persistence. Strong statement, isn't it? Now, I searched for the term relax in both the Middle Link Discourses and the Connected Discourses, the Majjhima Nikaya and the Samyutta Nikaya, and I could only find two references. It was the same quote in two places. But it isn't a quote for relaxation, is it? It's, my energy shall not be relaxed. That was the only reference I could find in those two books, and there's quite a few pages in those books. So it's quite an encouragement to keep trying, to not give up. Even on those days when you don't feel like meditating, it's important to just put your body there, to just sit, to just do it anyway. And so I'm going to end this talk by reminding you of the title. This is my closing advice. Relax, let go, and keep trying.